Welcome to Electricals 101, a brewer's introduction to what electronics do for us. My name is Drew Martinez. I'm the brewery engineer at Sleeping Giant Brewing in Denver. Before we get started, everyone, please take your seats and move to the center and make room for any latecomers, but it kind of looks like there might be plenty of room out there as it is. Please turn off or silence your cell phones to avoid any disturbance during the seminar. We will be taking questions during the seminar via Slido. Use the QR code or link. Use the QR code link and the CBC22 hashtag showing on the presentation screens to access the Q&A and polling. This room is called Ballroom A. We will also show this slide at the end of the seminar if you miss it now. Finally, at the end of the seminar, please also make sure to submit the seminar feedback survey. There's a short two-question survey associated with each seminar in the official CBC 2022 app. For this seminar, you can find the fill out survey button in the app below the seminar description. Your feedback will help the Brewers Association continue to provide better brewing education in the future. Now I'd like to briefly introduce the speaker for this seminar, John Blystone, PE. He's the manager of engineering and maintenance at Great Lakes Brewing Company and the chair of the engineering subcommittee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As he mentioned, I'm the manager of engineering at Great Lakes Brewing Company in Cleveland, Ohio. A little bit about myself. I've been working for about 17 years as a controls engineer, which is a fancy way to say an automation engineer, in a number of industries with about 9 years in the craft industry, all at Great Lakes. I'm a big believer in sharing knowledge whenever possible, so was working with the engineering subcommittee on our recent boil over protection white paper and talking with some of my contemporaries on the committee, as well as a bunch of smaller brewers in our area, and came to realize that the level of electrical knowledge was almost zero, and got me to thinking about all of the equipment we have in our breweries, no matter what size you are, and felt it was worth sharing a little bit of knowledge to maybe help you all converse with your contractors and your equipment suppliers. So here I am. Quick overview of the outline just to show all the stuff I'm hoping to cover. So buckle up. It's going to be an action-packed 90 minutes. I will leave time at the end for questions, and no matter where I'm at, in about an hour, I'm going to jump forward to the safety portion. I'm a big believer that safety's got to come first, especially when dealing with electricity. So you may not have heard of this fundamental law we have when working with electricity called Ohm's Law. And the interesting thing about Ohm's Law is that there's actually a fluid analogy, so I thought it would be a great starting point for this group to start with the way that we equate those two things. So on the left there, you see a diagram, very simple loop with a centrifugal pump, a bunch of pipe, and a hand valve. On the right, you see its electrical equivalent with a battery, some wires, and a resistor. So on the left, you can kind of think of the centrifugal pump as bunching up a bunch of molecules and creating pressure on the outlet. And with the valve closed, there's nothing going to flow. Now, if you look at the valve, you could say that it's got infinite resistance, right? It's resisting the flow infinitely. Whereas if you open the valve, it's very little resistance, and you get a very high flow. Same thing on the electrical side. If the resistance is very high or infinite, you're going to get very little to no flow or current. And if it's very low, you're going to get a large amount of current. And we talked there some terms about conductance and percentage valve open, but I think you guys get the point that the two are essentially equivalent, at least at a basic level. So, like I said, the pump provides pressure, and the battery does, in a way, the same thing, and that the amount of flow is determined by the resistance of those two items. So kind of building up to Ohm's Law, trying to avoid the equations as long as I can, but voltage equals the current, which is the flow, times that resistance. Similarly, power, or the power being delivered from the source to whatever load you have, is equal to the pressure times the flow. In the electrical sense, that's voltage times current. Power, which is typically expressed in watts, is equal to the current times the voltage. But if you combine V equals IR and P equals IV, you get P equals I squared R. this is kind of important when it comes to electrical, and I know I'm moving quickly here, but power is equal to heat. So devices heat from I squared R. I know it's afternoon on Thursday of CBC, so I'm going to be doing a lot of show of hands, try to get the blood moving. Who here has electric heating elements in their brewery? Show of hands. Wow, quite a bit. Excellent. This is how it's done, right? It's all about that current number, because the current squared times whatever resistance is there in those heating elements is what's delivering you that heat energy. This is a very common graphic. If you look up Ohm's law, this is right from Wikipedia. You can kind of see in the center there the different units: voltage, watts, amps or current, and ohms or resistance, and all of the things that those are equivalent to. Quick note for those of you with electric heaters, when you pull the head off, sometimes you'll have multiple elements, and this is kind of a note to say it matters how you wire those up. Series have the same current through them, but the voltage drop across each is going to be equivalent, whereas parallel, the voltage is going to be equivalent across both of them. And the currents add. So if you can look at the top diagram there, it's going to be the same current through both resistors, and the voltage of the battery that I've called VS or V supply is equal to the voltage across the first resistive heater and the second one combined. Whereas in the second diagram, the current through V1 and the current through V2 are added, and that's the current that your supply has to pump out. So again, practically, what does this mean? If you ever have to replace your resistive heating elements, just make sure you wire them up exactly how you found them. Show of hands, who knows the guy on the left? And guy on the right? Excellent. So hopefully half of you get the joke about AC/DC. Engineer humor, it's rather dry. So we'll start with direct current. What does direct current mean? Direct current just means that the electrons are all flowing in the same direction. Now, you see a bunch of diagrams that I'm going to be using here. The voltage is the vertical axis and time is the horizontal. So you can think of it as time is progressing from the left to the right. In the top, there's a diagram or a trend showing a battery voltage. Voltage is staying constant through time. Common in your vehicle, flashlights, things of that nature. Not very common in your process equipment. In the bottom, you see what's known as a rectified AC waveform. We're going to cover that a little bit more in a little bit, but it is also another form of DC, but it's derived from an alternating current source, and we'll cover what all that means here in the next couple of slides. So just focusing on DC, what are the pros? Well, if you ever look at the output of a computer power supply, it's all DC, and the reason being that it provides a nice stable voltage for all of the electronics in that device. We're going to talk about how that applies to specifically VFDs here in a little bit. And it's also easy to store, so batteries and capacitors. The cons, well, DC motors require brushes, and we're going to talk about motors in a little bit. But brushes have to slide on a commutator, little bars of copper, and they're wear items. Not only that, they generate sparks. Certainly bad when you start talking about the grain handling portions of our business. And there's an inability to increase the voltage to lower those dreaded I squared R losses. Remember, power equals the current squared times the resistance. Every wire out there has resistance. So even the wires that are transmitting power across this country or connecting all the different parts of the grid have an inherent resistance to them. The way we make it so those wires don't heat up and waste a bunch of energy and heat is we bump the voltage up, which drops the current. That's really the reason why we've standardized on AC. But anyway, you can't change the voltage easily with a DC system, so what you get is what you get. And there's no zero crossings, meaning that the voltage is never zero at any one point in time. And you'll find differing opinions on this, but typically DC is considered less safe. And we'll cover that in the safety slides, but if the voltage is never zero, your muscles never have a chance to let go should you contact an energized conductor. So alternating current, our buddy Nikola Tesla, for those of you that recognized him. And a short aside, I will say a book recommendation totally outside the brewing realm called Empires of Light. If you ever want to hear the fascinating story about how Edison and Tesla went to battle in the early 20th century, great book. Anyway, alternating current was kind of the system that Nikola Tesla had proposed, and he invented a bunch of things to make it practical in our lives today. But it is known for alternating, meaning the electrons are flowing back and forth, typically in a sinusoidal manner. As you see here, this is one cycle across 360 degrees of the sinusoid, raising up and down, and you can imagine that as electrons going back and forth in the wire. So this is the slide about that rectified DC. Diodes, the little triangles with a line on them in the upper diagram, those are basically electrical check valves. Again, back to that fluid analogy. So if you put alternating current into this arrangement of diodes, what we call a bridge rectifier, it takes that AC that's going, you know, electrons going back and forth, and the check valves or the diodes produce a pulsed DC on the plus and minus wires that you see in the diagram. And you can see that in the waveforms down below. The red is an alternating current waveform like you'd have coming out of your wall. And then ignore the green, but the blue lines up with the diagram up top that you end up with a pulsed DC. So the pros of alternating current, it's easy to generate, specifically in multiple phases, meaning that you have multiple AC signals that are out of phase with each other. Typically, and I'll say typically, it's three phase, meaning you've got three AC waveforms that are 120 degrees separated from each other. And that becomes useful when we start talking about motors, which we will in a little bit. And the big advantage here is that you can use transformers to adjust the voltage. If any of you guys were in the steam boiler talk, I think you heard Kent Taylor talking about reducing steam pressure and how that reduces the temperature and the advantages of doing that. So you boil at high pressure and reduce later for specific uses. Same thing here. We generate voltages at a relatively high voltage. If you ever go to a power plant, I don't think I've seen anything less than 480 volts, but I've seen all the way up to about 21,000 volts. Being generated and then stepped up even higher, upwards of about 350 kilovolts is our max in this country for long-term transmission. And then we step it back down with more transformers to a voltage that's usable for us. Not very easy to make a device like a vacuum cleaner or a pump that would run at 345,000 volts. So a lot of advantages there to be able to transform that voltage up and down for whatever use we need. The cons are it's very difficult to store. If you've ever heard the story of the 2003 blackout, one of the things that's pointed out is that it's very hard to store any energy when you're transmitting or dealing with AC. And efficiency is a very complex conversation as well. So it's got its advantages, but it makes our lives a little bit more difficult. So starting to talk about how we're going to generate AC, this is actually a diagram that's kind of showing a motor, but you can imagine it working in reverse. I'll get to the basics of voltage generation in a second here, but essentially a voltage is created anytime you take a magnetic field and pass it by a coil of wire, right? Or it's a coil of wire passing through a magnetic field, two ways of thinking of the same thing. And so in this diagram, we have what you can think of as a magnet on the rotating portion, and it's passing around those stationary coils. You can see the little blue lines, what we would call vectors, but those are showing the magnitude of the voltage in each one of those coils. So as the arrow is pointing towards the phase A coil, that's a positive voltage, and then when it's pointing away, it's a negative voltage. And then you can see the corresponding sinusoid over there to the right. We call those phases A, B, and C just to keep track of them, and they are exactly 120 degrees apart. A quick note here, and I know this seems like this is down in the mud on details, but we'll actually reference this when we get to variable frequency drives. The AC voltage that we refer to is actually what's called the root mean square, which is if you were to take half of that sinusoid and calculate the area underneath that sinusoid, that is what we refer to as the voltage. So 120 volts in the wall has a much higher peak. I say much higher. It's about 167 volts or so. The reason we do that is simple. If you were to take a AC source and hook it up to a resistive element, you remember Ohm's law, V equals IR. If you use the root mean square value, then everything works out, right? Basically, this is telling you how much energy you're going to dump into a resistive heating element like so many of you have without having to deal with the complexities of trying to take into account the AC waveform. So it's essentially the DC equivalent of the AC waveform when it comes to power dissipation and current. One final note on AC here, frequency. We'll deal with this again when we talk about variable frequency drives here in a little bit. Frequency is very basically the number of times that cycle happens in 1 second. Here in North America, we're primarily 60 hertz. I can't imagine anyone here is supplied with anything different, but it is out there, specifically in pockets around Niagara Falls. But 60 hertz is our standard, 60 hertz three-phase. In Europe, if anyone, show of hands, anyone from Europe, Asia, none? Okay, one. So you'd be familiar with 50 hertz over there. These standards were developed a long time ago, chosen to be as low as possible without being without us being able to see the flickering of light bulbs. So there's some advantages to having lower frequencies when it comes to efficiency and sizing of transformers or physically how big they have to be, but you don't want to see things flickering. Some of the earliest systems were actually 25 hertz up by Niagara Falls, and that was a big downside. Once they started becoming used for lighting, you could see the light bulbs flicker. It was giving people headaches. So an interesting note for anyone, show of hands again, who's flying home? Yeah, a lot of us. Interestingly enough, the airline industry is standardized on 400 hertz. It takes a lot of shielding to keep that signal out. It's a little bit electrically noisy, as we would say, but it allows transformers and motors and the like to be much smaller. So we kind of skipped over this, that basic electromagnetics, but how are electricity and magnetism related? So if a coil of wire is exposed to a changing magnetic field, a voltage is generated. If a coil of wire has current passed through it, a magnetic field is generated. So those two are very directly related. In fact, you'll hear a lot of people say it's EMF or electromagnetic force or EMI, electromagnetic interference. So those two are very closely related. And again, allows motors to work, transformers, it's how we generate AC. A couple of quick slides on transformers. Again, these are very simply just two coils of wire. We take advantage of that fact that current passing through a coil generates a magnetic field. We use an iron core to direct that magnetic field to another coil of wire, and the ratio of the wraps of the wire determines the voltage from the input to the output. So if you have 120 volts coming into a 10-to-1 transformer, you're going to have 12 volts coming out the other side. And just a couple of quick examples of transformers you might see around your facility or in a substation. The only note I want to say, and this is actually impacted us at our facility, that middle one there up on the pole, I know a lot of us may have moved into facilities that weren't necessarily intended for human occupancy. If those are nearby your facility, you might want to talk with your electrical supplier to talk about if they ever have to upgrade or change out that transformer, can it be moved away? Sometimes when the occupancy of a building changes, that's not necessarily on the radar of the electrical supplier. The only reason is those are oil-filled transformers. If you want some horrendous videos, check out oil transformer fire videos on YouTube. It's quite shocking. So those do happen. Again, if you can work with your utilities provider to move those away from your facility, all the better. And like I said, large, small, and more than meets the eye. Again, I warned you about engineer humor. Transformers and motors. So both of these, if you're dealing with a three-phase source, you may hear Y and Delta being tossed around. Again, the only real note for you is if you end up having to swap out a motor, make sure that you're following the wiring diagram for the given voltage. You'll notice that you'll see like a 120-208 panel in an industrial application, whereas at home you've got a 120-240 panel. That's just dealing with the three-phase source, that you'll have 208 three-phase, but if you go phase to the neutral of the transformer shown on the left, you get 120 volts. Very convenient. I know there's efficiencies to be gained if you have 480 at your facility, but 208 is normally very convenient. In fact, we had a 208 supply at our facility up until just a couple of years ago. So some more basics about motors. This is very generic, no matter what type of motor you have. That you've got a stator, which is the stationary part, the rotor rotates, typically some end caps with bearings and some sort of fan. The reason I point out the fan specifically, if there's one thing that you can do to keep your motors kind of tuned up, especially in dusty environments, is make sure that the fans and the air passages are blown off with compressed air and kept clean. It doesn't take much dust to start making those very inefficient, and the worst thing you can have is a hot motor. Metals don't like heat, as you guys know, in numerous applications around the brewery. So the other thing to watch out for is just those bearings. I can't tell you how many motors I've seen thrown out in my time because the bearings went bad. Typically, you'll hear the motor kind of start to growl or whine. You'll know it when you hear it, but typically that's just a quick set of bearings that can be pressed into the motor end caps and save the motor. So don't throw them out. It's quite a bit of metal waste. A quick talk about brush DC and universal motors. So again, you've got to have a piece of the motor that's rotating in a stationary magnetic field or something that's rotating in the stator, causes the rotor to turn. Brush DC and universal motors, just use a commutator. This is the sliding metal bars on the motor shaft there with a couple of brushes to transmit the electrical energy into the rotor. And that way, as it starts to rotate, the polarity of the magnetic field on the rotor switches, and it gets kind of pulled around a little bit further, which then causes the polarity to switch again. It gets pulled further. In breweries, you'd probably see these on tow motors, maybe tools that you might have. And I wanted to point out those two use cases specifically, again, around combustible dust. If you've got any buildup of combustible dust, and it is combustible, just be careful what tools you're using around those, what tow motors you're using around those. If you're a big place like us, I know we do have some like explosion-proof shop vacs and things of that nature, because pretty much all shop vacs that you find are going to have a brushed motor in them, not good when you're trying to suck up combustible dust. Our buddy Nikola Tesla, who was the left guy on that AC-DC picture, this was his big contribution to making AC what we have around us. When AC first came out, there were really no good AC motors, and Nikola Tesla had devised this, what's known as an induction motor. Now, it takes a little bit of a thought process to understand how it works. If you've ever taken apart an induction motor, you'll see the rotor is just a bunch of shorted copper bars. So what do I mean by shorted? I mean very low resistance. And you can see in this diagram a rotating magnetic field. The three-phase wire or the three-phase coils are in the stator, marked here in red, green, and blue. And those sinusoids that we saw in previous slides are causing the magnetic field to rotate in that stator. Now, if you put a rotor in the middle of all that with a bunch of shorted bars, you have to go back to think, how are voltages generated? As soon as you have a coil of wire, which is what this rotor is, in a rotating or changing magnetic field, it's going to generate a voltage. Well, the voltage causes a current. Current causes a magnetic field. And so the rotor is kind of self-excited to generate its own magnetic field, and it gets pulled around by the rotating field in the stator. The trick here is, though, that there has to be what we call slip. The rotor has to be slipping through that rotating magnetic field to generate that voltage. Hence why if you do the numbers, which we will here in just a second, or run through the numbers, you'll see that the magnetic field in the stator is rotating at precisely 1,800 or 3,600 RPM. You never see motors like that unless they're a permanent magnet, what we call synchronous motor. Most of the motors you have around your brewery are going to be an induction-style motor, meaning the output speed is going to be a little bit less because of this phenomenon. It's got to be able to slip through that magnetic field to generate its counter-magnetic field and follow the rotating magnetic fields around. So how fast do these motors turn? Like I just hinted at, a little equation up there in the upper right, the natural speed, NS, is 120 times the frequency divided by the number of poles. So what does the number of poles mean? You can imagine the diagram here is just a single-pole motor. So each phase has just one coil. That's one pole. You can actually double that up. You can have more than double. But those are the two you're going to typically see. A single-pole motor would be 3,600 RPM. A two-pole motor would be a 1,800 RPM, or what you might see as a 1,750. So we're going to walk through some basics of AC motor control. Who here, raise of hands, has ever reset a motor overload? Yeah, quite a few. We'll talk about exactly what does that mean. But this is how it's derived, the settings on that overload. I implore you, a lot of overloads these days are adjustable. If your overload keeps tripping, please do not do what I call the electrician's fix. Any electricians in the audience? Okay, good. Basically just take a screwdriver and crank it up all the way and say, well, that's not going to trip again. The danger there is that you're going to catch your motor on fire. I don't know if you've heard the phrase, but everything's a smoke machine if you use it wrong enough, and that's a great example of that. So short circuit interrupting is an important part of basic motor control. Overload protection, which is what that overload is, obviously. We'll cover on-off control and what we mean by a control circuit. So here's some diagrams. Again, the lines are wires. We'll talk about the other symbols here in a little bit, but you see in this diagram a forward and reverse push button, a couple of what we call normally closed contacts, and we'll cover that in a little bit as well, a couple of relay coils, M1 and M2, and then the overload coil. Again, notice the overload is typically wired into the control circuit. Please do not bypass that. I've come across that too many times as well. And again, the overloads are there to just monitor the amount of current going to the motor, because inside the motor, the wire is much smaller than the wires you're using to hook up to it. So you've got to monitor the amount of current over time going into the motor. If it's going to get too hot, then you need to interrupt that current. And that's what the overload does. It has in some way or fashion, a model of the wire and the design of the motor so that it can predict when the motor's getting too hot and interrupt the current flow. So back to some of those symbols, kind of start back at the basics. Electronics 101, so with a switch. On the left, you see the symbol and a picture of a normally open push button. Normal just means, when you're dealing with switches and relays, and we're going to be covering this again, I'll probably make mention of it again, normal is when there is no voltage or no force being applied. So if you have a normally open push button, that means if you're not pressing the button, the contacts are open. You can also have normally closed contacts, meaning if you're not pressing the button, the contacts are closed and they're going to pass current. Same thing with the switch. Notice the symbol there on the right-hand side of a switch showing the normal position. So in this case, off is what's being indicated. Switches can have multiple positions. They can have multiple contacts, and the different types of contacts are also possible on the same switch. So again, I'm only mentioning this because if you go to replace a switch on a piece of equipment, pay close attention to what all the contacts are and exactly where the wires are going. I know this sounds complex. I gave an example here of a car ignition, something a lot of us used to use every day. Here's another great show of hands. Who still has like a key twist ignition on their car? More power to you. I wish I had one on mine. Coming from the electronics guy, I've got the push to start and it drives me nuts. So anyways, off, everything's off. Obviously on, you got power going to the motor and everything. But then when you go to the accessory, it's going to apply power to the starter motor, or at least the starter motor relay, and then turn off all the accessories so that you provide enough power for the starter motor. And as soon as you let go, it's a spring return to the on position. As you can see, the little dotted line there and the switch indicator up top is showing that spring return position. So again, just trying to cover some of the basics you might see in your diagrams that come with your equipment. Short aside there, I don't know if any of you have ever purchased equipment and not received schematics or diagrams with it. Please, when you buy equipment, make sure that's part of your request to the equipment provider, that they provide a full set of schematics. There shouldn't really be anything there that's proprietary, and it's going to help you long term. Bring an electrician in to help fix whatever happens. So similar to a switch is a transistor. Now, we're probably carrying tens of millions of transistors around in our pocket every day now, but they are the basics of computers, and all it is a switch. So there's three pins on a transistor. It's the transistor in this diagram is the little circle in the bottom with a line in the middle and an arrow pointing down to the bottom. There's a number of types of transistors. In essence, for our purposes today, just think of it as if you apply a current or a small voltage to the one pin, it allows a larger current through the other two pins. So kind of think of it as a switch. But from that, you can build all of the logic gates that form the basics of all of our computing devices. Logic gates such as OR, ANDs, NANDs, NORs, NOTs, so on and so forth that form the basis of all the logic. A little blurb here about relays. So we mentioned what normal means when it comes to a switch. Same thing with a relay. A relay is just an electromechanically operated switch or set of contacts. So you can think of it as you apply voltage to the coil is kind of like pressing the button, right? So apply voltage to the coil of the relay. It's going to magnetically pull a contact or a set of contacts over, connect them in a different way, release that voltage or remove it. the spring internal to the relay will pull the contacts back to their normal position. Two types of contacts, normally open, normally closed. I didn't add it to the slide, but timer is also something you guys are probably familiar with. All that is a delayed response. You can think of it as applying voltage to the coil, and then it's going to wait a certain amount of time before it actually moves the contacts. Some examples here of relays. Coils have a defined voltage, so again, just be careful when you're replacing a relay. All of these things look the same. It's bit us a number of times, and it's not just the voltage. You can have 24-volt DC or 24-volt AC, 120-volt AC. Those are typically the three most common. And point of note here, DC coils, if you ever replace one, the polarity of the wires, which terminal they land on, is extremely important. Typically, there's a little diode in there, and if you wire it up backwards, it's going to cause a short circuit. And you'll notice that as soon as you try to power it up, it's going to probably pop a fuse. And also, be careful. Contacts have ratings. So just make sure as you're replacing equipment that you're keeping track of the coil or the contact ratings. Amps do not equal horsepower. So if you look at a motor, a small motor, it's going to list the horsepower and it's going to list the full load amps or FLA. Do not go by the FLA. When you're dealing with a motor, you have to follow the horsepower rating of the relay. So just a small point of note. Going to try to get you up to the point of talking through VFDs and a little bit about PLCs, just a primer again. But that all starts here with some electronics. I'll call it electronical engineering. Digital has two values, 0 and 1, off and on. Think of these as your light switch, your motor starter, your level switch. Analog has many values. Typically in electrical, in the electrical world, we express these as either 0 to 10 volt, 4 to 20 milliamp. If you're dialed into your PLC or have some visibility to its logic, you might see a range of numbers, such as 32A7 to 16383. Think of these as your light dimmer, your variable frequency drive. If anyone has tank pressure, that's all being expressed in an analog value. Also important to know is what we call pulse width modulation. So this is using digital to approximate an analog value. So you can think of this as if you were able to turn the light switch on and off really fast. If it spent about half the time off and half the time on, if you were able to do that fast enough, the light would be appear to you to be about 50% dim. This is common with electric heaters. Does anyone? I know we already asked who has electric heaters. Are they any show of hands? Are they just simple on-off, or do you have like some sort of temperature control? So raise your hands if they're just on-off. All right, very very simple control. Anything that's temperature modulated is going to use this, typically through what's called an electric or electronic relay, which is really just a very big power transistor. But the pulse width modulation is used all over our breweries. Again, may just not be noticeable. So finally getting to variable frequency drives. We were talking about pumps and motors, and I know if you came to Andy's talk before mine on pumps, he was talking a lot about how do you control flow on a pump. It's not uncommon to see a motor that's just on-off, and then you put a valve on the outlet side. I would argue a more efficient way to do that is to have a variable frequency drive and be able to vary the speed of the pump. And remember, the frequency is what determines the motor's speed. So we've got to somehow vary the frequency from 60 hertz all the way down to zero smoothly. Interestingly enough, and this is just a trick for young gamers, I guess, if you have any way of telling the voltage on a VFD, let's say it's displaying voltage on the screen, there is typically a relation that's linear between the frequency and the voltage. This is done just because if you don't vary the voltage, you'll end up with too much of a magnetic field. Magnetic field means too much current and too much heat, and again, metal likes to melt, so want to avoid that. So this is a typical volts per hertz relationship showing the speed in black and then the three phases that would be supplied to the motor. So we covered a lot of topics, and it all kind of culminates in this slide. Again, trying to build you up to the idea of how does a variable frequency work in a very generic way. We talked about bridge rectifiers creating a DC voltage from an AC source. We've talked about storing DC a little bit. Maybe we didn't, something called a capacitor. I'm sure you've seen the giant can-looking thing, typically wrapped in some sort of blue plastic. That stores DC energy. And then we talked about transistors, which are just electronic switches. and pulse width modulation, so approximating an analog value with a digital on-off signal. So that bottom picture shows how all these are put together in a VFD. So anytime you buy an inexpensive VFD, or maybe it's not so inexpensive, and you wonder, man, why is this as much as it is, this is why. There's a lot going on in there, and this is just a basic view. Again, all those transistors require some sort of computerized smarts to tell them when to turn on and off, to interface with whatever signals they're receiving from whether it be a switch or a potentiometer or the like. So there's a lot going on here. You see AC coming in from the left on the 1, 2, 3 through a three-phase rectifier into the middle part, which is the DC bus, and then some transistors to the right where the motor's attached. And then the diagram in the upper right kind of shows how the pulse width modulation is being used to approximate an AC waveform by which the computer can vary the speed and then vary the speed of the motor that's hooked up to it. One note, too, if you remember back to the slide about AC, and I was kind of rambling on about root mean squared, if anyone ever looks at their VFD and sees a DC bus that's, you know, 600-some volts, and you think, man, I plugged this into 480, maybe there's something wrong with my wall. Again, the peak of the rectified DC is what's being fed to the capacitors, and that is somewhere around 600 volts for a 480 drive. So don't be afraid when the DC bus is much higher than your incoming voltage. So again, just how fast does the motor turn? Frequency in that top part is what we're playing with on the VFD. So that allows us to vary the speed of the motor, typically down to zero if you need to. But point of note, I would really recommend that you only go down to about 6 hertz, about 10% of the rated speed. Also worth noting, it's sometimes okay to look into the manufacturer of whether it be the motor, the pump, or the gear motor. A lot of them will allow the motor to be operated up to 90 hertz or 50% over its rated nameplate speed without any decrease in warranty or MTBF or MTDBF, so mean time between failure. So they've actually rated their motors to run at a higher speed. They just don't normally publicize that. So if you get in a pinch, it might be worth reaching out to the supplier and seeing if that's an acceptable option for you. A little slide here on living with VFD. So practically, what do you need to know? And this is a recommendation. I don't know if there anyone from Crohn's in the audience. I'll single you out. Quick raise of hands. This is actually a screen grab from our main bottle filler, and I'm giving them a big thumbs up because this saved my bacon about a month into working in the craft beer industry. The main VFD in our bottle filler died. And if it wasn't for them documenting all of the parameters at the end of their startup and commissioning, I would have been up a stream, man. So if the supplier of your equipment does not do this, my recommendation is either ask them or somehow go through your drive as soon as you get the equipment and it's powered up and everything's humming along and their guy leaves from commissioning because, you know, they might be playing with some of these parameters. Get in there and try to record all the parameters, especially the ones that may have been changed from factory default, because if you ever have to replace that drive, that's going to save you in the end. And I say just try to record the ones that have changed. That's always the best option because, as I like to say, it's almost parameter-geddon. Modern drives will have thousands of parameters, so recording every last one is not really feasible or needed. Another thing that's great to have on hand is the actual manual for the different models of VFDs you have. So shown here is this was the main drive on that bottle filler was a PowerFlex 70. In this case from Rockwell Automation or Allen Bradley, the manual for that tells you all of the details on those parameters. So if you are curious about exactly why these parameters are set the way they are, or you think maybe you want to change one of them for whatever reason, please reference those manufacturers' manuals. They're typically excellent, an excellent resource to have on hand. Quick note about binary, again, as we're trying to work towards the intro to PLCs, another engineer joke, there are 1-0 types of people in the world, those who understand binary and those that don't. 1-0 in binary is 2. So again, computers are built on transistors. We covered those earlier, just on-off, electronically controlled on-off switches. So everything they do at some level is a series of on and off, what we call bits, right? So each transistor is a bit. It's on or off. There's only those two states. So memory in your computer, or if you've got a phone, let's say it's a 12 gigabyte SD card, which is pretty small by today's standards and totally random number, but that's 12, I believe, billion bits, right? So that's how we keep track of the available memory space. And just a quick table I threw together here to show how does a computer count in binary. So everything being base 2, you see the 8 bits there in the top. On the left, you see MSB, which is the most significant bit. Over to the right, you see LSB, which is the least significant bit. And computers typically start at bit 0. And the reason you do that is everything is kept track of in 2 to the whatever that number is power. And so in this case, the least significant bit is 0. 2 to the 0 is 1. So if that bit is on, then that equals what we would know as decimal 1. Likewise, the second bit, or bit 1, has a power of 2. So if that bit's on, you're going to add 2 to the decimal number. And so just a quick table there showing what, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then I jumped to 8, and then picked a random 167, and then the maximum number that you can display with 8 bits is the number 255. So just a quick primer there on binary. Again, you might come across that, especially if you're looking into some of your VFD parameters, sometimes configuration parameters in a PLC-controlled system and the like. You'll see some sort of number that is comprised of individual bits like that. Floating point nonsense, I just threw this in real quick. Computers, if you noticed on the previous slide, don't naturally count in decimal. And so how do they handle it? There's a group my wife calls IE. It's actually the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. If this is probably no surprise, I am a member. They came up with a standard for allowing computers to count in decimal. And so it's a way to describe a much larger set of numbers. The problem with it is there's some imprecision to this, and I only lay that out there if anyone ever decides to get their fingers into programming PLCs and play around with things. This is something to keep in the back of your mind that, yes, they can display decimals, but there is a level of imprecision to them, so you've got to be careful how that might impact your application. So why computers? Programmable logic controllers. So I kind of mentioned that name a couple of times. You've probably heard PLCs or seen some out on the show floor. It's interesting to note this industry actually owns programmable logic controllers. So the gentleman there in the bottom left is a guy by the name of Dick Morley. He invented them in 1978 during a hangover. Him and his buddies were drinking beer on New Year's and woke up the next morning, and they had been talking with a bunch of engineers at General Motors about what they were trying to accomplish with their first industrial computers there in the late 70s, and it had finally dawned on them during that hangover that they needed something that they could operate in that state. They were trying to find something that was just easily modifiable, and it hit on them that they needed something that could be programmed in a language that was pictorial and already familiar to all the electricians in the industry. So before PLCs, what did we have? I've actually seen a panel similar to this on the left where you just have banks and banks of relays. The number of relays here, I would approximate to be maybe equivalent to like one of our drop packers, right? That you'd need that many relays to control a relatively simple machine and all of its various functions. And you can imagine what's the failure mode here, right? One of those relays is going to die. Maybe the contacts weld and it stays on when the coil's de-energized. Maybe the coil burns up and it doesn't pull the contacts in when it is energized. And all of a sudden the machine starts acting funny, and you have to figure out which of those relays is the one that's broken. I've heard horror stories from old electricians that would approach giant panels. One specifically used to work at Ford before working with us a number of years ago, and he was working on the lines that would grind camshafts, and they would have just lines and lines of panels filled with relays. And as an electrician, they knew, well, that line needs these 8 relays, or it uses these 8 relays. And they'd walk out and just kind of start guessing on, well, I think it's in this part of the ladder logic or the wiring. So they just start randomly replacing relays until the machine started acting the right way. It really was just a troubleshooting nightmare. So computers have helped fix all this, and a PLC is really just an industrially hardened computer. A small picture there on the right will cover some more detail. It's just an industrially hardened computer, runs its logic continuously, meaning that it's going to take a look at all of its inputs, it's going to interpret them, run them through whatever logic is programmed into it, and then change the state of all of its outputs accordingly. Can handle, typically, both digital and analog signals, so we covered those earlier, so both on-off and a range of values. Most have some sort of communication capability. So whether that be to other I.O. racks and distant panels, drives, your touch screen, and the like, you'll see a lot of different communication protocols. Most everything these days is Ethernet, but there are some other ones out there. And not that there's pluses or minuses to any of them. They all have their points of use. And some are even safety rated. Does anyone here, show of hands, do you have any safety PLCs in your place? I know, yeah. Yeah, so that's a whole other level of complexity. You can imagine when you start entrusting like e-stops and safety to a device made of transistors, there's a whole bunch of other standards that PLC, that device has to adhere to and has to be tested to. Typically, you'll actually see two processors in the rack, and there's a method for both of them to run the same code and compare the result. And if the results don't match, it then executes an e-stop as well. But it is nice. It gives you some flexibility, but the cost is very high. The only places we have them at Great Lakes is on our package fillers, so our bottle filler and our can filler, just because of all the guarding and the ability to jog with doors open at a low speed, things of that nature. So there's some advantages there, but very high cost. So different parts of a PLC. So this is kind of a generic one. This is an Allen Bradley PLC that we've got at our place, but there's many different varieties, many different manufacturers. There's pluses and minuses to all of them. I'm not here advertising for Allen Bradley. It's just what we've kind of standardized on. Power supply just provides power to all the different modules. The processor is typically the first one in what we call the rack. So this whole thing is called a rack. And then you have all the input-output cards or I.O. cards, and they can be mix and matched, typically, if it's an expandable system like the one you see here. So you've got a DC input, DC output, two analog inputs, which you could wire, say, tank pressures or flows, and then a counter or encoder card if you're trying to monitor the speed or maybe the position of a piece of equipment, things of that nature. So how do you program them? Again, anyone here have PLC programming software anywhere in your brewery? Have you gotten your fingers into this? Show of hands, a couple. Good to see. I always like to throw out the phrase from Spider-Man, because guess what? I'm a comic geek too, that with great power comes great responsibility. But I'm really glad to see that. Play with the machine until you get it to do what you want. I really appreciate that approach. So every manufacturer has their own software. It's typically unique to the type of PLC hardware and normally the PLC's firmware revision. So I mentioned we're a Rockwell house or Allen Bradley. Every revision of firmware in the Rockwell world, you have to have a different version of the software installed. So just keep an eye out for that. Sometimes if you're having a connection issue, that's why. Most of these are programmed in what we call ladder logic. We'll cover that in a second. But you may also see function blocks, sequential function chart, structured text. And another show of hands, because I know it's Thursday afternoon. Who here's ever had like any sort of programming? Like, doesn't have to be ladder logic, any sort of programming whatsoever. C, Java, doesn't matter. Great. So this is another programming language. It's kind of odd in that it's pictorial, but if you have any sort of programming experience, there's some translations there, and you can pick it up, I promise. It looks funny, but it's just another programming language. So this is a little diagram of ladder logic. This is actually captured for some code that we wrote internally for our louder ton, I believe part of the louder grain out. But you see the different rungs of the ladder. So kind of show a picture of the ladder over there on the right and the equivalency there. You have different instructions on every rung of the ladder. And the whole philosophy behind this is that the rail or the vertical line over on the left is your hot rail. That's where the power is coming from. And then every rung, it kind of passes that power from the left to the right through a number of different instructions over to some sort of output instruction. You can think of this as if it was just relays. You'd have a bunch of contacts on the rung, and if all those contacts were passing power, whether normally open, normally closed, whatever, then it would pass power to a coil over on the right side of the ladder rung. Again, I mentioned the genius of Dick Morley and his hangover. I really wish I knew what he was drinking that night. But the genius of that was that this was the way that all of those old relay cabinets were documented. So how were all the relays wired together? They had ladder diagram already. So his genius was to take what all the electricians were already familiar with and turn it into a programming language. A little slide here about some of the, I'm going to say function block diagrams. So this is just another way of programming PLCs. Anyone here have a lot of Siemens in their plant? No? We've got one Siemens processor. If they're out there on the floor, a lot of their stuff is programmed in this. This is kind of like their natural language, basically because of their prevalence in Europe. But it is available in Rockwell, and likewise, Ladder is available in Siemens. Just a different programming language. Does the same thing, though. We talked a little bit about analog signals. How does that apply to you? You know, there's a couple of different styles of analog signal you'll see typically used in industry, whether 0 to 10 volt or 4 to 20 milliamp. I'll say try to avoid the 0 to 10 volt if you can. We mentioned that wires have resistance, so in the diagram on the left, showing a little analog input on the right and a pressure transmitter on the left, the resistance of the wire is actually going to decrease the voltage on the analog input. So the further away from the control panel it is, the more wire you have, the more resistance in the wire, and the voltage is going to drop on the way back to the analog input. Current is going to be the same all the way through that loop, right? So on the right-hand diagram, if you have the same pressure transmitter, but it's a 4 to 20 milliamp loop, 0 to 100 PSI equals 4 to 20 milliamp, that 4 to 20 milliamp is going to be the same on the analog input card. The other advantage is there, if you have the choice, and again, most of your manufacturers or equipment manufacturers should default to 4 to 20. There's a lot of advantages here in that if the instrument goes into a failure mode, it can produce a signal that's outside of that 4 to 20 milliamp range, so you can detect that in the PLC software and throw an alarm on a screen. You can also detect the absence of an instrument. So if that conduit or that wire gets pulled out, because, you know, I've driven a tow motor before, hate to admit it, and ran into a bunch of stuff, which is why I'm not allowed anymore. But it happens, right? And these things get damaged, cords get damaged, the instrument gets damaged. On the left, you wouldn't know it. It would just look at 0 volts and say, I've got 0 PSI. On the right, it's detected as a negative pressure, which you know is not possible, and you can alarm for that and throw an alarm on the screen, whatever. Another note about cabling. So if you are in the position where you have to do the field install or you hire an electrician to do a field install, point of note here, and again, I'm trying to kind of the practical note here, trying to find an electrician that has industrial experience. Not all electricians are created equal. Even some of the low voltage guys that are used to doing alarms and what you would think is kind of a low voltage install in the commercial space may not understand the details of an industrial setup. And this is a great example. So when you're wiring instruments into the field, even if you're running them in a conduit, you should use a shielded twisted pair wire. And the reason being that you know, we all have Wi-Fi on our devices now. If you have VFDs running, there's all kinds of electrical noise, like almost a radio frequency noise that you can't see, you can't hear. But if you have a loop of wire out into the, let's say, from your main control panel all the way out to a tank, that loop of wire is just a giant coil. And as we talked, a changing magnetic field and a loop of coil generates a voltage. So you end up with a bunch of electrical noise in your signal. So this might show up as all kinds of imprecision in your tank values, your temperatures, who knows what. We remedy this by taking the wire and twisting it. So you can think of the loop as every loop is going to generate, let's say, a positive voltage. Well, when you twist the wire, that voltage goes from positive to negative to positive to negative to positive all the way down the length of that wire. And so the twist actually negates the effect of EMI on the signal. And to further protect those wires, we wrap them in a foil and have a drain wire, as shown on the right, some sort of metallic shielding to help prevent that EMI or electromagnetic interference from even getting to those wires. If anyone has, like, some of the EMI-proof wallets, same thing, right? EMI, electromagnetic interference, radio waves, whatever, have a real tough time getting through through a solid metal shield. Speaking of temperature signals, so a couple of common temperature signals that you're going to be around in the brewery space, thermocouples and resistive temperature devices, or RTDs. So a note about thermocouples, they are not all created equal. There's a small chart there showing just some of the thermocouple types on the left. Thermocouples are a really interesting device. There's a property in physics that if you have two dissimilar metals and you touch them and weld them together and expose those to a temperature, they will generate a millivolt signal, very, very faint signal. Now, I don't like faint signals. Again, it's a voltage signal. We talked about why we want current signals instead of voltage. So the advantage here is that they're very inexpensive because you're just taking two metals and welding them together into some sort of probe. So they're very low cost. The disadvantage is the entire effect by which they operate is dissimilar metals, meaning that you've got to keep the same metals all the way back to the device that's reading that temperature. Okay, so if you don't, you'll end up with, like, let's say you take a thermocouple and then wire it through a normal terminal block to a pair of copper wires and run it all the way back to your panel. The temperature of that terminal block is going to impact the temperature that the thermocouple's reading. So you're going to end up with some temperature issues there. It's not going to be accurate at all. Not only that, because it's a millivolt signal, it's very, very, very delicate signal, and it typically is very imprecise. Most thermocouple input cards out there are plus or minus almost 3 degrees. So you've got a 6-degree window that by the manufacturer, they're saying your temperature is going to be somewhere in here. It's really not okay for things like mash temperature, send down temperature. You might be okay with it on your fermenters. Not too sure. The other thing to think about is what metals there are. So we've got a bunch of type J thermocouples. I don't know why. When I got to the company, all the fermenters had type J thermocouples, I'm sure, because they're inexpensive. The downside of that is that one of the wires is actually iron. It's just iron. So you can imagine if you have any sort of ingress of beer, which is acidic, or CIP chemical, that iron disappears real quick. Not only that, it's fragile, so you don't want to bend the wire a bunch. So just removing the device to replace the thermocouple a couple of times. We've had wire snap off, which is always fun because you can jokingly tell your intern to go get the wire stretcher and not see him for the rest of the day. But you're pulling new wire all the way back to the panel is what ends up happening. RTDs, on the other hand, are a little bit more expensive, but they're incredibly more precise. This is a resistive temperature device, so a device where the resistance changes with temperature. You'll see 2, 3, and 4 wire, and the cost goes up with every step, but so does the precision. Typically with a 3 wire, you can get within about a 0.1 to 0.2 degree Fahrenheit accuracy range, and the 4 wire even more so. So again, applications for you guys, if you're dealing with mash temperature, send down temperature, and I would argue sometimes fermenter temperature, if it's that critical to what you're doing, you may want to look into retrofitting or asking from your manufacturer to have RTDs instead of thermocouples. Either way, another option is they make these great little 4 to 20 milliamp transmitters that fit into the heads of the instruments. If you've ever seen like a thermocouple head sticking out the side of a tank, there's these little pucks that you can wire either type of instrument to, and then it'll generate a 4 to 20 milliamp signal back to some type of controller. It's a great option. Because, again, at that point, distance doesn't matter. You can use a shielded twisted pair wire. There's some advantages there. A little bit of loss of precision, but it's an interesting option. So talked a little about PLCs. I want to talk about analog inputs. Again, this is a range of values. We talked about the 8-bit word of information coming in, the different values. On the right there, I show basically a precision table. So I show 4 to 20 milliamp there on the left, and then how many bits of precision that analog instrument or analog input has, and shows you the number of steps that each bit represents. So again, when you pay for a PLC, this is just all part of the conversation typically with your equipment provider. If you're going to upgrade to RTDs or something that's a little bit more precise, you may want to converse with them about, how are you factoring in the precision of the analog input to make sure that you're not paying for an RTD, but that precision is wasted once it gets to the analog input. If you take a look at like a 12-bit analog input, you only have 3,200-some steps from 4 to 20 milliamps. If you upgrade to a 14-bit, now all of a sudden you have 13,100 steps. So, again, it's going to help if you're paying for a precise instrument. Again, just talk with the equipment provider to make sure they're factoring that in to the conversation. So, again, trying to keep it practical, thought we'd talk about flow meters, so some of the devices that are in the field and how those work. We've talked about magnetism and electronics a little bit and how those two react. So you all have heard magnetic flow meter. Show of hands, how many have a magnetic flow meter in their brewery? Yeah, great. So for these, the fluid must be conductive. They are somewhat sensitive to bubbles, but high-end models have tolerance for entrained air, or CO2 or whatever. And care must be taken to bond everything around them because, again, they are magnetic. So typically you'll see everything, both sides, needing to be electrically bonded. But when a conductive fluid, passes through a magnetic meter, you see these little coils there in that diagram. And those coils are inducing a changing magnetic field, and there's pickups on the side. And that changing magnetic field is able to be it will impact the voltage on those pickups proportional to the speed of the fluid through the meter. And then the inside of the meter is a very precise cross-sectional diameter, and that determines your volumetric flow. The point here is if you ever have any sort of damage or a nick or anything that would change that inside diameter of the flow meter, it's going to impact your precision. So just keep that in mind. If you have something that, you know, nicks or damages or over time maybe wears out the lining on your mag meter, you might need to have it calibrated. And a note about that here in a minute. On the right is probably one of my favorites, a Coriolis mass flow meter. Anyone here have a Coriolis? They're pretty expensive, kind of rare. But the fluid does not have to be conductive here. They're less tolerant to entrained air and bubbles than a magnetic meter, and they're more sensitive to the up and downstream conditions. So why are we using them? Well, they're really neat instruments. They're extremely precise for mass flow, and they're also able to give you the density of the fluid at the same time. The one place that we use these at Great Lakes is for an automated send-down into our automated cellar. Not only is able to calculate flow rate, but then gives us the density of the fluid, and we're able to see the change between push water and wort on the way into the fermenters and switch valves automatically. The way they work is really neat. Anyone here an electric guitar player? I fumble through it myself. So similar method, actually. There's an excitation coil in the middle of two almost tuning fork tubes. And then you have pickups, very similar to an electric guitar pickup, on both sides. And the frequency at which the coil in the middle kind of vibrates those tubes, it varies a little bit. And it's looking for what is the natural frequency of those tubes. The natural frequency determines the density of the fluid inside the tubes. And then as that mass inside the tube starts to flow through them, you'll start to see a phase shift, as indicated on the right there, where the tubes kind of start to do this instead of just bouncing in and out. And that ends up being equivalent to mass flow. So a really neat instrument, but you can imagine the amount of electronics that go into them and the precision needed. So they are a little bit more expensive, but they do have some great applications, especially if you need flow and density at the same time. The other place you might see these would be in a Vorloff loop. Just a note about flow meters in general. 27 CFR 25.42, periodically test means at least once a year, at least according to the last TTP gentleman that I had in my office, means that you have to calibrate them to within 5.5% yearly. Now, I will say, if you read the law, it says tax boundaries, and you know where that's at in your brewery, I'm sure. But I will tell you from my experience that they wanted to see all of our flow meters calibrated to within 0.5% at least yearly. So just a note there, if you have flow meters, doesn't matter the type, you've got to calibrate them. And typically that accuracy range means you should probably be using a magnetic or a Coriolis for those tax boundary applications. Finding a paddle wheel or some sort of magnetic flow meter that meets those criteria is, I'll just say it's difficult, but I think it may be impossible. This is for your reference later. I'm not going to go through these, but a bunch of codes and standards. We like to say codes are written in someone else's blood, so it typically behooves you to read them. But a couple of notes here. You'll hear sometimes reference the NEC, the National Electric Code. This is something that, and we'll talk about how to talk with contractors or find a good one, something that you'll want to talk through with them. When was the last time they were trained up on the latest version of the National Electric Code? That's how to install things in such a way that they won't catch on fire. Interestingly enough, that's kind of the basis for how all these standards got started and why the National Fire Protection Agency, or NFPA, still runs the standard. NFPA 79, Electrical Standard for Industrial Machinery. That's a great conversation to have with your equipment suppliers. 70E is one that we're going to cover in a little bit that you're going to need to know as an employer or a worker. It's electrical safety in the workplace. 70B, if anyone in the maintenance world here, raise your hands. I've got my two guys here. Yeah, great. So if you're turning wrenches around your shop, there's a standard on recommended maintenance for electrical equipment to make sure it's going to perform as expected. And then a couple of UL standards there for control panels, both in standard applications and then in hazardous locations, which, again, we all have typically some combustible dust, if not in some ways, especially with some of these seltzers, possibly ethanol and some other fun things in our environment. So some different standards there. So, again, how do you talk to contractors? Again, ask them who is their authority having jurisdiction. When were their workers last certified as qualified electrical workers? Can they provide examples of their safe work practices? When was their last NEC knowledge assessment? What type of PPE do you have? When is it cleaned and inspected? It should be cleaned often. It should be inspected all the time before every use. What energized work are they going to perform, right? I know, you know, I'm a member of all kinds of Facebook groups, and I'm sure you guys are in this industry. A number of pictures of people opening energized panels to modify parameters and things. You're around high voltage components. It's really something you've got to be aware of. We're going to cover that in the next few slides on safety. And equipment builders, again, verify panels are built to UL standards. Depending on where you're at, the city's going to want to see that before they give you an occupancy permit. They'll come in. The electrical inspector typically will want to see UL ratings of panels before they allow you to apply power. And make sure you discuss the equipment location and the hazards present, right? I can give you some examples of equipment I've seen where it's obvious they didn't mention that, hey, this is going in my mill room and it's going to be covered with grain dust all the time. That's an important conversation to have. And again, you, as an employer, realize that electrical safety matters. So now on to the electrical safety portion. So why electrical safety? I'll tell you, in my almost 18 years, I've seen some pretty horrendous stuff, not only in our industry, but specifically others. And it shows in the OSHA statistics, right? Of the fatal four in construction, electrocutions is the third one on the list. And of those four, I would argue that electricity presents the scariest hazard, right? If you don't get electrocuted, which means, by the way, death by shock, I always like to – who did the safety boot camp here with Stitchfield? Yeah, he always makes the comment of, you know, how many people have been electrocuted, and you have people raising their hands. Well, that means death by shock. So unless you're revived on the table, you've been shocked, not electrocuted. But not to split hairs, but again – any type of shock is some really scary stuff. You can expect exterior second and third degree burns from either an arc flash or shock. We'll cover what those mean in a minute. Explosion of tissue, all right? Internal fourth degree burns. If you don't know what a fourth degree burn is, look up a fourth degree electrical or RF burn. It'll scare you. Fibrillation of the heart, clamping of the heart and diaphragm, permanent nerve damage. I've met guys that got shocked, and 5-10 years later, the pain that they were feeling, the one guy commented to me that he wished he'd been electrocuted. It's that bad. So how do you prevent all these horrible things, right? So general electrical safety. All electrical equipment should be grounded, three-prong or double-insulated. The symbol there, the two squares within each other, shows a double-insulated. So if you have like a drill, typically those are double-insulated, you should see that symbol on the handle somewhere. The ground pin there, the ground pin that's missing, I'll share a story, and it's kind of embarrassing, but we did get to the root of it. We had a bunch of fans in our packaging area, and they kept coming up with broken-off ground prongs, and for us, that's like we'll walk out and immediately cut the cord off so that they can't use it, you know, near the end. And finally, we started asking them, guys, why do we just keep showing up with a missing ground prong? And I said, well, that's the only way we can get them to fit in the outlet. And so you walk up, and the outlet had a broken-off ground prong in the outlet. So all we had to do was remove that, and all of a sudden our ground prong stopped disappearing on us. But, again, very important that, especially for those of us working in wet environments, that you make sure your ground pins are intact. And, again, just run your hand over electrical cords. The picture in the bottom, you can see it's common if you pull equipment out, the outer cover kind of pulls out of the socket there. Throw it away. It's not worth it. The next thing to get damaged is possibly going to be an energized conductor. And, again, in a wet environment, it's not worth playing with. And you'd be surprised how many cables we've seen get pinched in doors or under a tow motor wheel that look like the bottom left. Couple of notes about, again, general electric safety, circuit breakers and ground fault circuit interrupters. So let's cover GFCI first. So GFCI, similar to like what you have in your bathtub, it's a really neat device that monitors the current going out the hot and back on the neutral. It has nothing to do with the ground. And if it notices that those two are not in balance, it'll trip, meaning it turns off the power. These are typically used in wet areas. They're required in homes around sinks, baths, kitchens, things of that nature. I would really recommend trying to install those everywhere throughout your brewery because pretty much everything you plug in is in some way or at some time going to be used in a wet environment. You can also buy the little portable units like you see here, the little yellow device, so that if you don't have GFCIs everywhere, which they are expensive, you can plug that in and kind of use it and have it follow you around for whatever you're using to make sure that the device you're holding in your hand or working around is protected by GFCI. You can have GFCI breakers, but those are typically a little expensive. And to reset, it says follow the same procedure as a circuit breaker. So circuit breakers in our world are a little different than what you have at home. I know we're all pretty commonly used to resetting circuit breakers in our home. In the industrial space, it's a little bit different. The amount of energy is significantly higher. So this is the recommended procedure here for resetting a circuit breaker. And I know it sounds silly, and we'll cover why here in a second. But if the breaker trips, typically means it's in some sort of middle position. You want to put your hand on it. You want to get as far away from it as possible. So you're stepping an arm length away. Take a deep breath. Turn your head away from the breaker. Close your eyes. Turn it off and all the way back on. And the reason you do all these things, as we'll cover in a minute, is if something fails in that breaker and it ends up basically exploding, called an arc flash, we'll cover that in a second, your body's first instinct is fight or flight, and the first thing it does is inhale, right? Typically, the brightness is such that if you were staring at it, it would blind you. Plus, your eyes are very delicate. Sometimes it could be flying metal, which, again, we'll talk about in a second. But that fight or flight response means you inhale. And if you happen to be right in front of a breaker and inhale what's coming out, it means you're inhaling, you know, 30,000 degree Fahrenheit molten copper and smoke. So just a good practice there when you're resetting breakers. Just take the time, train yourself, hand on it, get as far away as possible. And before you actually turn it off and then back on, deep breath, look away, close your eyes. So to get a little morbid, because this is the heart of the electrical safety, I care deeply about this industry and everyone in it. I don't want to see any electrocutions. So we're going to talk a little bit about the two ways to die from electrons. Those are electric shock and electric arc flash and arc blast. Electric shock occurs anytime current passes through the body. So most outlets are protected by a 20-amp breaker like what you have at home. And here's a table here showing how many milliamps or thousandths of an amp it takes to cause various levels of damage to the human body. So by the time you get to 3 milliamps, you're feeling a tingling sensation. By the time you get to about 200 milliamps, which is what, one hundredth of what that breaker is going to trip at, you've got enough current going through your body to cause ventricular fibrillation, and you're on the boundary of clamping your heart. So to prevent shock, never open electrical panels, always inspect cords like we talked about before you plug them in, and use a GFCI whenever possible. I say whenever possible. I can share another quick story. We had Ironheart by a few years ago. Some of those mobile canning units, because of the VFDs and the way they kind of pull power from the outlet, they'll continuously trip a GFCI. All I can say is the only workaround we found was to just plug them into a non-GFCI outlet. But again, that's a special case. I just implore you, anytime you can, please use a GFCI. And then arc flash and arc blast. So an arc flash is the sudden release of energy caused by an electrical fault. Temperatures in these events can reach up to about 35,000 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 10 times hotter than the sun. I know that seems unlikely, but it is true. You'll see a picture here in a second. To avoid injuries, please leave all work on electrical equipment to qualified electrical workers and avoid the electrical work area when they're working in that area. There should be an arc flash boundary. You as an employer or an employee, talk to your employer. According to the National Fire Protection Agency 70E standard for electrical safety in the workplace, you should have an arc flash study done. Your panels and equipment should be labeled, and you should not be opening any of those panels unless you're a qualified electrical worker. I know that can be painful, but we're going to talk about how to get around that here at the end. So let's go back to the first way that electricity can kill you, electric shock, right? So you say, well, I know guys. In fact, I actually met an old electrician who would test 120 circuits by kind of tapping them with his thumb. Just bothered the heck out of me. And he did make it to retirement somehow. So how? Well, your skin resistance varies. It depends on how wet your skin is, you know, how much water you drank, the properties of your body at that specific moment. So your skin is your biggest protector against shock. However, nothing is a perfect insulator, right? So your skin is typically a decent insulator, but think about it. Lightning is able to make it through air, which is arguably one of the best insulators. And here's a picture, probably one of the least graphic I could find, of an electric shock. This gentleman got shocked between his hands, which is arguably one of the most dangerous paths because it's crossing, you know, through your chest, one hand through the arm and out the other. These are the entry there on his right hand and exit on his left hand wounds. This is based on what I'm seeing and what I've seen in other incidents, probably pretty soon after the incident. Typically, those start to look a lot worse in the weeks that come. And I can give you horror stories. I'm not going to the whole group. But if you need more proof on avoiding shock, please catch me after this. And a note here, if you ever receive a perceivable shock, and this does seem like overkill, but I implore you, if you ever feel a shock, please seek medical care very quickly. Ask them. There are blood tests that they can run to look for internal damage, and they should perform an EKG on you. There are stories in industry. In fact, our electrical trainer who comes by every 3 years knew a gentleman who passed away after an electric shock, and it wasn't immediately. He got shocked at work, said, okay, my heart's pumping a little adrenaline, went home, ate dinner, went and sat down in his recliner, went to sleep, and that was it. So his heart had entered AFib, and he never woke back up, right? Tied back to a small electric shock that he had received. And it was that mentality of, well, I've been shocked before. Well, you never know, all right? So please, if you feel a shock, go get checked out. Again, help to prevent that, a nice little diagram. This is from the National Electric Code's NEC handbook on how a GFCI works, showing how the imbalance of the current between the hot and the neutral, if the current is going through your body any more than 5 milliamps out to ground or anywhere else, let's say through a failed cable or something electrically wrong inside that equipment, the GFCI device will notice that imbalance and say, I should be sending out as much current as I'm getting back. If that's not the case, I'll turn everything off. And notice that most of these are set to trip at around 5 to 10 milliamps, which is right in the area where muscle contraction and pain starts to happen, but below the let-go threshold, which just means that the let-go threshold is there's so much current that above about 20 to 40 milliamps, you actually physically can't let go of the wire, which is scary. I've talked to guys that said they rode the lightning. And it's no joke. They had a buddy that saw them kind of clamp onto something and thankfully pulled the plug before the guy sustained serious injuries. But you clamp on, you know fully what's going on, and you just can't let go. So I have a sticker on our main gear. I didn't put it in the presentation, but it kind of jokingly reminds you as you're walking in that not only is this going to hurt and kill you, it's going to hurt the whole time you're dying. So give it some respect. So the second thing is arc flash and arc blast. I mentioned that your employer should have an arc flash study performed. And an arc flash, again, that explosive release of electrical energy. This is a lab setting that is a dummy. You can't quite see it because of the brightness of the event there. But there is an electrical fault in this disconnect, and this is someone turning it on with the cover open. Again, if you're not a qualified electrical worker, all the covers of your equipment should be kept closed. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute here. But this is a fault that they basically applied power to something. There was a fault internal to it, a short circuit, and that panel erupted in a ball of fire. What's happening here is essentially the copper in that panel is vaporizing, again, over 35,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that type of heat very quickly causes an arc blast or a pressure wave, so it's an explosion event. We'll talk about PPE here in a minute. You'll see that it's all rated in calories per square centimeter. It's taking care of the heat portion of this. So there's an engineering study you have done that's that arc flash study to take a look at what energy is available at all of your electrical panels. And then what PPE do you need to safely work on that in an energized state? It stops at around 50 calorie, and I'll tell you that our main electrical gear at Great Lakes is north of 100 calories per square centimeter. We just don't do live energized work on it. The reason being, above about 40 or 50 calories, the pressure wave from the arc blast is enough that it's going to crush you anyway. There's no point in saving you from the heat. So again, just trying to instill in you the danger that's present. You may not have an issue with this. Again, especially a lot of the smaller places, arc flash might not be an issue because if you have a smaller transformer outside, there might not be enough energy available. But the only way to know that is to have that study done or have a professional come in and take a look at the situation to make sure that you're clear. You know, I say here, have a blast at work. Don't experience a blast at work. I hate to keep pointing this guy out. This was... you know, from the old adage of, well, it couldn't happen to us, right? We've been working at this facility for so long, it could never happen to us. I know a few of you recognize this location. If you ever come on a tour, I'll show it to you firsthand. This is an individual that had turned off the local disconnect. So on the front of the panel, there's that disconnect. He had turned it off, thinking, all right, I've turned off power to most everything in the panel. The falsehood in that is that the wires coming into the top of the panel were still energized. This is a 208 panel. This is actually one of our lower energy panels in the facility. He then proceeded to reach underneath the top of the panel and start tightening a conduit nut. He was starting to run some Ethernet down to that machine so we could get this machine onto our Ethernet network for remote access capabilities. And that conduit nut happened to pinch one of those energized wires up against the grounded case and resulted in that blue ball of flame emanating from behind his crotch. The gentleman went to the hospital the next day, had first-degree burns. The day of, had a little bit of molten copper kind of stuck to his arm that just brushed off. Again, this is one of our lower-energy panels, and why I say you really want to be a qualified electrical worker and you never work in energized panels. This is work that, you know, he could have taken the time to go upstream, turn off the breaker that fed those panels, verify with all of his PPE on that there was no energy in that panel. Now you're okay to take the PPE off and work however you feel necessary. But this is absolutely what we don't want to see. Thankfully, the top of the panel protected his eyes, so he was pretty lucky there. This is some of the damage. Again, that the picture on the right shows where the wire got pinched. You can kind of see where some of the nut there, the conduit nut, just disappeared. It vaporized. And then you can see the little fuse holder there that was about a foot away where some of that metal actually deposited itself. So you can think that metal was still molten by the time it hit the tip of that fuse holder and cooled off enough to stick there. So if your arm's anywhere near that, you can imagine how that would feel. So again, please leave the electrical work to the qualified professionals. Not to embarrass one of the attendees here, but a little picture of some of us at Great Lakes in our ArcFlash PPE. I like to use this picture as a demonstration or kind of a test. If you think you're a qualified electrical worker, I challenge you, look at that picture. There are six things wrong. If we were about to go into that panel that my hand's leaning on, there are six things that are wrong, and any one of those should prevent us from being allowed to open that panel. So if you think you're qualified, I challenge you to find all six and let me know. But that's a picture of our lowest level ArcFlash uniforms. Our maintenance guys wear those every day to work. Some of our engineers do as well. And that's pretty standard if we're going into any type of energized panel just to protect us in case something were to happen. Final thing here before I get to Q&A, are there any manufacturers in here, any equipment manufacturers? Raise your hands. We'll single you out. None. Well, great. So we're going to talk about how we can talk with our equipment manufacturers. And this is something that is out there in industry, not so prevalent in our industry, and I'm not sure why. Again, for as much as we care about safety and trying to push it forward, if you guys have ever worked in an automotive industry or any larger corporation, you'll see this out there. It's what I call designing for safety. You separate all of the low voltage components into a separate physical panel and leave the high voltage stuff in a different panel entirely, right? So in this instance, this is some wastewater treatment equipment over there on the right that we installed at our latest facility. Two high voltage panels at the bottom, with absence of voltage verification units that are certified by the manufacturer to verify when you press the button that there's no energy in the panel. And then the upper panel that I have open here, I'm able to do that without any PPE. You would be able to do that as a non-qualified electrical worker because there are no hazardous there's no hazardous voltage in that panel. It's all 24-volt DC. The line in the sand is 50 volts, by the way. So anything that's 24 volts, you are free to go in and poke around on. There's no hazard there. I mean, outside of, you know, maybe wiring something up incorrectly, the problem comes when you have any voltage in a panel that's above 50 volts from ground. You should not be in that panel. That should be reserved for qualified electrical workers only. So again, the idea that we can design for safety, if you ask your equipment providers, as I have, please try to design this into the systems when you buy them. The cost is there. It's marginal. But again, long term, it's going to allow you to safely troubleshoot your equipment because most of what you care about is in that low voltage panel. All of your PLC IO, timers, relays, those types of things, fuses, power supplies, you can keep those in the low voltage panel for the most part. So talk to your equipment providers about that. The last point I wanted to make before I get to Q&A here was the idea of plug-mounted or plug-supplied equipment. At our last facility, even though it looks kind of unprofessional, we hung cords from the ceiling and provided everything with these the manufacturer's Meltrick, but there's a number of different manufacturers that offer these large three-phase plugs that when you unplug them, there's a little shield that pops over the energized conductors, and there's a spot on the plug for you to insert a lock. If you don't know anything about lockout, tagout, again, safety boot camp, or reach out to Matt Stitchfield, safety ambassador. I'm sure we'd be happy to fill you in on safety protocols there for lockout, tagout. But when you unplug a plug and put a lock on it, that's the only way that you as a non-qualified electrical worker can verify that there is no energy in that panel, because you can physically see that all three of the phases are disconnected. You know that there's no power. Lock it out, and now you're safe to work on it. So, again, some considerations there for designing safety into whatever future systems you may buy. And the cord-mounted thing might be an option for you to go back and retrofit just for the cost of the plug. So an option there for some good functional safety. So we've covered a lot. I know it was meant to be kind of a breeze-through intro to all things electronical, as I jokingly called it. So any questions, please hit me up. I've got my professional and personal emails there. Again, I can't tell you how much I care about this industry and about safety. So especially if you have questions on electrical safety, please reach out. So that's what we've got. Q&A here. So are mag meters affected by temperature? For example, will hot kills on a knockout line affect the long-term accuracy of the meter? I can say that there are some... A lot of the instruments I've seen, the high-end instruments, will have some sort of temperature compensation. Long-term, I don't think that's really an effect on accuracy. Most of the accuracy reports you see, the calibration is done at a specific temperature. As long as that lines up with the manufacturer's specs, that's not an issue. Long-term, I don't believe so. I can tell you our send-down flow meter has been in place for a long time, 1998 install, and it's still within 0.5%. Good question, though. Are most pump motors repairable or not in the case of burnout? Pretty much any motor is capable of being repaired. You can look up a motor repair shop. I'll tell you, though, the rule of thumb right now, and it might change now because of the supply chain issues, right? If you can't easily get a 5-horse motor, then rebuilding it's an option. So any motor of an industrial design can be rebuilt, but typically the cost is not feasible for anything less than about 20 horsepower. The only motor we've rebuilt in my time at Great Lakes was our 40-horse centrifuge motor. Pretty much everything else is just scrap it and replace. Where can I get deeper electrical training for brewery application? Recommending courses. I'll say I'm a big fan of YouTube. I know it's kind of informal, but there's a lot of great resources out there on the web. Search around. Check out your local community colleges, right? There's a lot of great resources there as well. And I implore you to take a look at the industrial courses. What we do is industrial manufacturing, at least when it comes to electrical. There's really nothing unique in the brewery world that you won't find in other industries. And so take a look for those like industrial electrician or electrical technician training courses. You'll find quite a wealth of information there. For wet conditions, which plug is best for 40-volt pumps, pin and sleeve, twist lock, blade style electrical? So my comment there is to take a look at what type of washdown capabilities there are, both when something's plugged in and when something's not. For the longest time, we had just like the blade style electrical plugs with the outdoor cover, right, like a gasketed cover. That's great until you open it up and plug the pump in. All of a sudden, all that water resistance is gone. And so you can find, and I didn't cover it today, there are some ratings for water and dust ingress into electrical devices, either NEMA or IP. So you may have heard IP67, IP68, NEMA 4, NEMA 4X. You can look those up online, but you can find plugs that are NEMA or IP rated in both the unplugged and plugged in state. And as long as you pick one of those, you'll be fine. What is the purpose of the ground pin? Does it make accidental hose down safer? So I'll say yes. So the ground pin is there. If you ever open up your electrical panel at home, typically you'll see the ground wires tied in or connected with your neutrals, and it's kind of confusing. The neutral is meant to be a current-carrying conductor that is referenced to ground. It's kind of the technical way of saying it. So they are supposed to be at the same potential. This is why they're all bolted together in your panel. The reason we run a separate wire, though, is that if the neutral were to become disconnected or some sort of fault were to happen in the electrical equipment, the ground wire is not meant to be current carrying. It's just for safety purposes. It's typically wired to the outside of the equipment, the conduit, the plug itself. It would help make things safer. If you did get water in there, then water would be a path for electricity to flow to ground and then blow the circuit breaker or fuse. So, yeah, it does make hose down safer. Next question, sinking versus sourcing input. So that's a great question. What are the reasons to choose one over the other? So sinking or sourcing inputs refers to, in layman's terms, whether the presence or lack of voltage results in a input being considered activated. Okay, so a sourcing input typically means that the voltage is on for the input to be considered on, where sinking is the other way around, right? I would suggest that you talk with your equipment manufacturer. Typically, the only reason that you would use the other, where like the lack of voltage is logical on, is because it's easier on the electronic side. So typically, I'll say you see these in lower cost PLCs, sometimes in real fast responding input cards, but they're confusing, right? Most electricians are confused by that fact that the lack of voltage is a logical on or activated. So I typically say try to stick to the sourcing inputs and sourcing outputs if possible. The next question, does the NBAA offer any practical electrical training for non-electricians? That's a great question. I will say I know they've got a great maintenance and engineering course. Check that out. I can tell you I'm actually just accepted the role as the director of that course, and we are talking about possibly adding some more electrical training to the curriculum for that. So keep your eyes peeled. Again, I would recommend, though, that if you're really into this, take a look at your local community colleges. What we do is really analogous to everything done in industry. So a lot of options out there. Does the energy miser that contractors install in panel boxes work? There's a lot of little gimmicky things out there that I've seen. My opinion, very few of them do anything. The only thing I have seen that works is what's called power factor correction. If you remember back to the AC slide, I said efficiency becomes a complex conversation. Sometimes in larger industries or in industrial areas, you'll have what's called a kVAR charge on your electric bill. And that's basically the power company saying your system is inefficient, and you can adjust that with the capacitor banks and complex control systems. I think the energy miser thing, though, is kind of bunk. So, and I doubt that we're not in an area that capacitor banks make sense. I doubt anyone here is. They're pretty costly. So what is an acceptable electrical safety practice? So, again, always working on de-energized equipment, completely de-energized equipment. If you can't do that, then call a qualified electrical worker. I know that's kind of flies in the face of a lot of practices right now, but that is what electrical safety means, right? If you're not qualified to be in and around energized parts, please avoid it. And last question here, is there a ballpark lifespan on thermocouples, assuming they're not exposed to corrosive environments? No. Again, it's just two metals twisted together. I will say, if this is an ideal case, if they're not exposed to anything corrosive, after a while, the moisture in the air will corrode the metals in the thermocouples. So I don't know that you could get it to a corrosive-free environment unless you did like some sort of nitrogen purge on your conduits. So realistically, is there a lifespan? Yeah, I think eventually they'll burn out. It depends on the environment they're in. I can tell you at Great Lakes, I think we have some that have spent their entire life on the side of a fermenter without problem, and we've got some that have been touched with a little beer 10 years ago that we have to replace. So, electrical sustainability practices. Yeah, so great question there. I kind of joke about, when you're growing up and your dad sees the lights on, well, who's in the room, Turn it off when you're not there. There's nothing like that, right? One of the biggest users of electrical power is motors. And so if you can get by with, say, turning off your air compressor over a weekend, if that's acceptable to you, just keeping an eye on, walk around and think, where is all my electrical power flowing? And if you can't really think about it by looking at the devices, go to your breaker panel. Look at how big the breakers are. The bigger the breaker you can turn off over a weekend, the better off you are. Lights are another big one. Air conditioning, adjusting your temperature set points like you might at home. So if no one's in the brewery, adjust your temperature set points. same thing goes with glycol, right? I know we all like keeping a constant glycol temperature, but depending on what your process is doing, can you modify the glycol temperature so your chiller doesn't have to work as hard? There's a lot of little games there you can start to play to try to save some energy beyond just installing photovoltaics and that kind of thing. So that would be my recommendation. Just try to turn everything off that you can. Can you come back and train on how to use a multimeter and other tools? I can. Again, that's kind of a bigger talk regarding that whole qualified electrical piece. I guess give you a bigger, better window into like what we train at Great Lakes. To become a qualified electrical worker, you typically have to have some experience in the field, be trained by other electricians. And then we have a two-day training every 3 years and at least a one-day training refresher every year, plus a skills test. That we're still working on defining, but that's the Q, right, qualified. They've got to qualify and prove to the authority having jurisdiction, which is me for us, that they can identify energized components in a panel, that they know safe work practices, that they know how to use their PPE, they know enough about how to identify when the PPE needs replaced, on and on. It's a much bigger conversation just how to use a multimeter, but I would be happy to. Again, especially on low voltage circuits, I think there's enough room for safety there to say, yeah, I could teach how to use a multimeter. And again, please, engineering committee for the BA, we're always ears open. If you guys have things that you want to be seeing at these types of events, especially from the engineering technical side, we're all ears. We're here for you. So love to know your input. And can BA have you teach us in Cleveland? Welcome anytime. How do you troubleshoot issues when you have to measure voltage inside a panel if you have to cut power to be safe? Well, that's exactly the problem, right? Again, why I would implore you to talk with your equipment providers to move the low voltage equipment where most of your troubleshooting is going to be done into a separate panel so that you can get in there and take a look at it. Otherwise, the only safe path is to hire an electrician, and I know they don't come cheap. So again, please try to have those conversations with your equipment providers. See if you can keep the low voltage stuff in a separate panel. So thank you for your time, everybody. I hope you got a good intro to electrical. So safe travels home. Thank you.